It's on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Just a note, the following conversation may include language that is challenging for some of our listeners, so listen with caution. A federal judge from Savannah, Georgia, made American history 25 years ago this month. Clarence Thomas was confirmed as an associate justice to the Supreme Court on October 15, 1991, but it was the media circus that surrounded his confirmation hearings that made Thomas a household name. A young law professor named Anita Hill came forward to testify against Thomas before the Senate Judiciary Committee. The nation watched in disbelief on this very day in 1991 as Hill alleged that Thomas made unwanted sexual advances toward her, and those descriptions were graphic.
He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises or large breasts involved in various sex acts. On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess.
Clarence Thomas denied any wrongdoing, and then he threw his own accusations into what has now become an iconic phrase.
As a black American, as far as I'm concerned, it is a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves, to do for themselves, to have different ideas. And it is a message that unless you kowtow to an old order, this is what will happen to you.
The U.S. Senate very narrowly confirmed Thomas, 52-48, and he became the second African-American on the high court. Today, we will look back on his tenure, and I'm joined by Georgia State University law professor Tanya Washington. Good to have you back.
Good to be here, Celeste.
And also with us is Stephen Gottlieb. He teaches at Albany Law School in New York. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tanya, this high-tech lynching that he was talking about, that very concept, is something that he's kind of stuck to throughout his career and has repeated in various permutations. I want to play this clip from a 2013 interview on C-SPAN. They asked Clarence Thomas if he ever thought he'd see an African-American become president, and here's what he said.
I knew that it would have to be a black president who was approved by the elites. The media, because anybody they didn't agree with, they would take apart. And that will happen with virtually, you pick your person, any black person who says something that is not the prescribed things that they expect from a black person will be picked apart. You can pick anybody. Don't pick me. Pick anyone.
I'm going to pick him, though, because it almost sounds as though he's responding to people who say that he's too conservative. Is that fair?
I think what he is trying to say is that unless your politics or your expression of your politics is aligned with the established order, the status quo, that you are not going to be deemed acceptable or appropriate, and that determination, your qualifications are made based on that rather than, you know, the quality of your analysis or the work that you've done or, you know, your educational background, et cetera. And I think, you know, he has been consistent because his comments there describing why President Obama was an acceptable candidate despite the fact that he was African-American is in line with his own his comments about his own confirmation.
And Stephen, what do you make of this? I mean, especially the hearings. Without us retrying the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, do you feel as though Clarence Thomas has been able to move away from that and have his legal career be judged separate from the confirmation hearings?
Oh, I think that's true. Despite the fact that he doesn't speak at oral argument, his opinions speak very forcefully for a point of view, and by the way, I think he's right that there is an extra millstone on the neck of African American candidates, and they get.
Do you mean any candidates or candidates for the court?
I was being more general. I think he's quite right, and I've seen it work where people misinterpret what African Americans say and their positions, which may have something to do with why he does not speak. By the way, he does speak; it's just not public. He speaks to Breyer all the time.
Yeah, I don't think anybody thought he was mute.
They tell jokes to each other, and it's obvious from the audience in the court.
We're going to get into that, but let's go back a little further in his history and talk about his growing up in Georgia, because it's something that he has talked about as helping to form the justice that he is. Here he is speaking about his early days in Savannah.
I was the only black kid in my seminary in Savannah in 1965 to 67, and one of two in 1964 to 65. So you could see the world hadn't changed in Savannah. What I found in getting along with the white classmates is to look at them not as white kids or as different, but as kids. There's some less flawed, some who are flawed, some less flawed. I don't know. But in the end, they're all human beings.
So Clarence Thomas was born in Pinpoint, Georgia, in 1948, which was not an easy time to be a black kid in the South. How do you think that experience may have influenced him as a juror?
Well, as he expressed, he tried to see kids not for their color, but as just children that he was in classes with. And I think if you fast forward to a lot of his jurisprudence that expresses the idea of colorblindness as the constitutional ideal that we are going to apply the law without regard for color, it's consistent with the ways in which he navigated those spaces where he was the only black person, was to not see the color of his classmates. And perhaps, you know, in his experience, that made it easier for him to navigate those challenging spaces.
There's some other things that he did. He dropped his Georgia accent. He made sure that he was a picture-perfect example of a smart, educated human being.
He attempted to assimilate, and he also worked really hard not to fit the stereotype. But in doing that, you don't give yourself permission to be yourself. We don't have to be perfect as black people or black jurists to be equal. And that attitude of I must assimilate in order to be treated as equal, I think resonates throughout a lot of his opinions as they relate to topics around race.
We're going to get into that for sure. We would love to hear from those of you listening. How do you think history will remember Clarence Thomas? We asked on Twitter. Ted Barfield tweets, hopefully as a great and accomplished man, there is no basis for any other remembrance unless you're a hopeless demagogue. And Craig Flook tweets, what we'll remember most about Thomas is being, quote, replaced by an Obama. Tweet us now. I think that's hopeful thinking for you at least, Craig. Tweet us now at OST or join our conversation on Facebook. My guests are law professors Tanya Washington of Georgia State University and Stephen Gottlieb of Albany Law School. I'm trying to say there's no, at this point, no plans for anybody to nominate President Obama or Michelle Obama to the Supreme Court. I assume that's a little bit of a joke. But I wanted to go back, Stephen, to your comments about Clarence Thomas not talking. And when we say he's not talking, he's not speaking up or asking questions pretty much hardly ever during his entire time on the Supreme Court. In 2013, he actually broke a 7-year silence. There was a discussion going on about the qualifications of an attorney. It sounds like Thomas was trying to poke fun at the expense of Yale Law School. So Thomas uttered 4 words. Well, he did not. Let's take a listen here to what he said.
But Ms. Lehman at that time was a very experienced attorney.
And another of his counsel, Mr. Singer, of the 3 that he had. He was a graduate of Harvard Law School, wasn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
Son of a gun.
Very Is that the minimum constitutional?
He did not.
He says, he did not provide good counsel. But it wasn't a question. People keep waiting for him to question people. Stephen, why doesn't he?
He hasn't told me, to be honest with you. one can speculate that there's been he has said from time to time that he doesn't see a lot of benefit in the process of oral argument, and therefore doesn't participate, although he's there. And he's there and he's active in other ways. So he gets books delivered to him. He sends things back. You can see that there's a degree of activity that he's present during the arguments. He just doesn't articulate what's going on in his mind and hand for the audience.
And that's one way in which he's sort of distinguished himself is by being silent. But another way, Tanya, is that he was not the African-American judge many African-Americans were waiting for. In other words, somebody that might bring a very different, more sympathetic perspective to the court. Here he is during a forum at the Pepperdine University School of Law. He was asked about whether or not the Supreme Court has a role or a duty in combating racism.
I have never understood the notion that we could continue to focus on race in order to get over race. I've never understood that we have to continue to identify us in a, you know, to be race conscious in order not to be race conscious.
What can we glean from his decisions on issues of race?
Well, I think he's summed it up. He is of the mindset that the way to get over racial discrimination is to end racial discrimination. In other words, not to see race, to adopt a colorblind perspective and a colorblind jurisprudential philosophy where the law is neutral and takes no account of racial inequities, racial disparities, racialized realities. And that comes through in his opinions in the voting rights context, in the context of affirmative action, employment discrimination. So his perspective is one that if we really want to become a colorblind society, which he perceives as the ideal, the thing we do is to ignore race. Others who critique that perspective say, how can we eliminate racial discrimination, which clearly still exists by, you know, hard evidence,
right?
Yeah. How do we get rid of that without first acknowledging the history and the reality of racism?
Can I supplement Tanya's answer there? I certainly agree with what she was saying, but I think there's an additional thing that we need to understand, and that is, while on the one hand he talks about colorblind, and I would even describe what he's saying as what blacks don't get for themselves isn't worth having. But when you look at another set of cases where issues are raised on behalf of white parties, his jurisprudence is completely different. So when you look at, for example, there's a whole spate of cases involving the way the districts were drawn in a number of states.
Gerrymandering, yeah.
Various forms of gerrymandering and the application of the Voting Rights Act. And even in those situations where blacks were underrepresented, he was finding that the white group in that area wasn't sufficiently represented. So there's a dilemma there or a contradiction there. There are a whole lot of different legal questions that were used to address those situations. But ultimately, what's going on is that there's a preference for white complaints in a fairly large group of cases.
Douglas Hooker tweets, Clarence will be remembered as a first and as an icon of don't judge the book. Don't judge the book by its cover. I think that's relatively fair. But it's not just racial decisions, I think, that Clarence Thomas has had a real impression on. Let's hear from him. This was an oral history interview. Former Georgia lawmaker and NAACP chair Jolene Bond was speaking with Thomas about what goes through his mind when he's writing his opinions.
These opinions have an enormously long shelf life. So it is critical that they not be based on shifting sands of fads and what's popular, but rather principles that are locked down and that will be here when the tides turn or the wind blows in a different direction.
So, and we also got a tweet from somebody called Rabbit, who says Clarence Thomas was in keeping with his time, but neglected to shift positions when it failed. Assimilation cannot bring equity. Tanya, what will we remember of still live and kicking and doing quite well, Clarence mm-hmm. Thomas, but what kind of legacy has he built so far?
I hope that we will remember him for his competency as a jurist, for his intellect, and not for the scandal that plagued his confirmation.
With Anita Hill.
Right, with Professor Hill. And I, you know, my objections to some of the positions he's taken are political. Right. I disagree with the positions that he's taken. But questions about his competency and his ability as a judge on the Supreme Court, who had a higher ABA rating than Rehnquist, who served as the chief judge for many years, to me is the wrong critique of his work. I think his opinions are, for the most part, consistent, at least as consistent as that of other justices on the court, some of whom, I disagree with the positions they take as well. So I hope that he will have, an earned reputation as a jurist who expressed a certain perspective on the law, original intent, and what he considers to be kind of apolitical decision making, although there is no such thing as neutrality, in my opinion. But I hope that will be his legacy and not the legacy that's centered around his confirmation.
And the reason we're talking about it is because 25 years ago today, Anita Hill was accusing him of sexual advances. Tanya Washington is a law professor at Georgia State University. Stephen Gottlieb is at Albany Law School. Clarence Thomas was confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court 25 years ago this month. Tanya and Stephen, thank you both so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Celeste. Take care, Stephen.
You too.